From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Most of the U.S. media has been preoccupied trying to parse the various utterings by Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, all the while obfuscating the substance of the massive leaks of data showing wrongdoing by Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and the DNC, with Cold War accusations of Russian spying and interference in the U.S. election. We instead bring you the balance of a two-part newscast featuring a wide-ranging discussion with internationally recognized historian and author, activist and lawyer Dr. Gerald Horn of the national and international context in which the U.S. election is taking place, featuring analysis from a policy perspective of the candidates' positions on the important issues facing the world today. Dr. Horn's most recent book is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary.
With the Crimean intervention, Germany was pushed successfully away, at least for the short term, from Russia. But now, with the Brexit, you have these glimmerings of sentiment in the Foreign Office in London about Britain being sort of a free agent and also serving as sort of a beachhead against the European Union. Now, there's also a possibility that Britain will also sign up with Washington's messianic venture against China. There is a very important development taking place right now with regard to Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, pulling the plug on Hinkley Point, which was this joint Chinese-French venture to build a power plant in England. It was signed on personally by President Xi Jinping during his trip to London some months ago. It was seen as the inauguration of a new golden age in London-Beijing relations. But now, with Theresa May having second thoughts about that, that's calling into question that particular orientation of British foreign policy. It's helping to give rise to this idea that Britain will now double down on its relationship with Uncle Sam, not only as a possible beachhead against the EU, but also as a possible alliance against Beijing.
Yeah.
If that takes place, of course, this will have repercussions with regard to Russia, which already has deep and profound relations with China. Xi Jinping and Putin have met so many times that people are beginning to talk. So this is the state of play as we speak.
You know, and that, the publicizing of the second thoughts that May was having about this deal with Beijing, which also is, by the way, part of, I think, a package of five or six deals that China's now saying, if you don't want one, you don't get any of them, which, you know, is a further deterioration. But that came out within 24 hours of this leak, quote unquote, of this satellite evidence or aerial evidence that China, horror of horrors, is hiding planes on the Spratlys.
Well, yes. I mean, if conflict comes between the United States and China, a flashpoint will be these offshore islands that China claims, and of course, the Philippines also claims, in addition to other Southeast Asian nations. You may recall that just a few days ago, the World Court ruled that the Philippines have a valid claim in that part of the world. China has pledged to ignore the World Court decision, which is understandable because we all know that if we look at how the World Court has dealt with Africa and has not dealt with, say, war criminals like George W. Bush and Tony Blair, it becomes difficult to take the World Court seriously, not to mention its companion, the International Criminal Court.
Right.
So this ratcheting up of tensions with China is going to be a noticeable aspect of politics in 2017, whoever is elected president in the United States of America. And in that regard, I would point to A Straw in the Wind, which is a recent book by the Financial Times columnist Gideon Rachman entitled Easternization, as opposed to Westernization, of course, where he suggests, as many commentators have previously, that we are living through an epical millennial transition of power shifting from the North Atlantic to Asia, and more specifically, China. Now, we know that historically, such power shifts inevitably have been accompanied by conflict, sometimes murderous conflict. And this is something we have to be on guard against, because we know that U.S. imperialism and their acolytes see it as their birthright to exert white supremacy, not only domestically, but globally. And the rise of a paramount China is, shall we say, inconsistent with the basic predicates of white supremacy, as we traditionally understand that phenomenon. So this, like a cold front meeting a warm front over the plains of Nebraska, inevitably can lead to a tornado-like effect that, if we are not careful, could spell doom for humanity.
There's an interesting contradiction, or maybe a set of contradictions, between Clinton and Trump with respect to China, particularly Trump saying on the one hand repeatedly throughout his campaign, do we really need to go to war with Russia and China? And he says, and China, all of the times. On the other hand, Clinton's policies, if they can be divined from what's happened in the past, have favored China in terms of economic relations, maybe more specifically American capital in China. And Trump is challenging that material aspect of the relationship, in rather strident terms. I wonder what that looks like from Beijing.
Well, as we try to figure out what ruling class policy is, particularly with regard to this bedrock issue of China, a couple of formulations come to mind. It seems as if one wing of the ruling class, and let us not forget that despite the defections of people who are considered to be hawks and neocons, Donald J. Trump still has a considerable amount of ruling class support. Carl Icahn, for example, the Manhattan billionaire, not to mention this board of economic advisors that he just announced that studded with various billionaires and miscreants of various types. Right. And that Trump faction of the U.S. ruling elite seems to be harking back once again to the pre-2014 Obama strategy, which is relaxing tensions with Moscow so as to be able to better confront China. Whereas the Clinton faction seems to want to not necessarily relax tensions with Russia, but to ratchet up tensions with Russia and perhaps take over, if I can put out that demented idea, take over or deeply influence Russia so as to have that as a platform through which to attack or undermine China. So I guess what we have is the Trump faction saying basically China first in terms of a point of attack, and the Clinton faction saying Russia first as a point of attack. Now, it seems to me both ideas are rather demented. However, it seems to me that if I'm a ruling class bettor, and if I'm trying to put my chips on one of those horses, Russia is a country of 150 million. China is a country of 1.5 billion. China is a number two power rising with a bullet, pardon the expression. Whereas Russia is a powerful nuclear power, is not necessarily a powerful economic force, although the debility of the Russian economy has been overstated by people like Senator John McCain. And it's very interesting, you have this discourse on Russian weakness economically, yet they're able to hack into allegedly the CIA, Democratic Party, Clinton's emails, etc. So in any case, both strategies, it seems to me, have fundamental and structural weaknesses, and both strategies ultimately, it seems to me, spell doom if carried out.
You know, there's something about the orientation of Germany towards Russia and the U.S. wishes for, you know, to direct that against perhaps its natural flow. Going back to 1989 and earlier with the reunification, there was apparently a struggle inside Germany between essentially industrial capital, productive capital, and finance capital, where as the industrialists saw the changing environment around them, were looking at Russia like, wow, we're going to go make a lot of money developing Russia and all those resources, etc. And finance capital, apparently working in tandem with the United States, was like, no, we're going to loot it later. And that was the path that was followed. I'm wondering if Trump doesn't represent some sector of the productive or particularly construction capitalists in the United States, where they're sitting around with this huge untapped labor pool, all these huge needs for infrastructure development, housing, construction, all of that, watching finance capital make a fortune on Wall Street and everywhere they're playing, that capital not being available to them. And there's an antagonism, particularly between construction and finance capital, that you can see at the closing table when they close on the financing for their deals. But I'm wondering if maybe Trump doesn't represent some portion of the U.S. economic elite that wants to stop spending money on the military and to stop allowing finance capital to extract so much value from the economy and let them have some to go to work.
Well, it's clear that there are those in the U.S. ruling elite who would like to rein in finance capital. I mean, I think that that is understandable given the events of 2007-2008, the downturn on Wall Street, which obviously contributed mightily to the defeat of Senator John McCain in 2008, since he proved himself incapable of addressing that sticky wicket in particular. And it's also interesting to note this conflict between Berlin and Washington. It's not only the fact that Germany, a country of 82 million, has taken in about a million refugees who have been fleeing Syria in particular, but not Syria exclusively. And I should say parenthetically that this has not only been a so-called humanitarian gesture by Berlin. If you look very carefully, you'll notice that Germany has basically plundered the healthcare sector of Syria, with doctors and medics from Syria flooding into Germany. Not only that, but like many European countries, Germany has a demographic problem. That is to say, its population is growing older, and its population, which is increasingly migrating to the pension sector, needs a core of young workers, and those hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria and other countries like Eritrea are now going to become that youthful sector of labor to keep the pensioners afloat. At the same time, you see that the United States has had difficulty in absorbing maybe 10,000, 15,000 Syrian refugees, with even progressive Vermont being the latest state to turn thumbs down on absorbing more Syrian refugees, Rutland, Vermont in particular. At the same time you have that conflict, you see how Volkswagen, this major German company, which it was caught with this hand in the cookie jar, that is to say that it was seen as fibbing with regard to the ability of its cars to pass pollution tests. But this has led to a mad scramble by not only the United States government, but also state governments to loot Volkswagen, driving down its share price simultaneously and calling into question the future of this foundational German company. Then there's Deutsche Bank, which is really on the ropes right now. I mean, it's incredible that bank is still afloat. It's the major German bank, but yet it's hemorrhaging cash with every passing second.
A lot of it right here in the U.S., by the way, on bad mortgages.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a worldwide phenomenon. And then at the same time, you have this recent Financial Times article just yesterday about how Chinese companies are plowing into the manufacturing sector in Germany, buying up companies left and right, particularly companies of the future in the robotics sector. To the extent that that trend continues, it's going to be very difficult to keep Germany on side when it comes to Washington's anti-Moscow plans and anti-Beijing plans. And keep in mind that Germany was not necessarily on board with regard to the NATO intervention in Libya in 2011. And there is some consternation in Washington about the reliability of this so-called NATO ally. These are some of the complicating factors that whatever administration is incoming in January 2017 will have to grapple with.
And I wonder if we could shift focus. One of the things that is happening right now was the referral of the articles of impeachment for a trial of President Dilma Rousseff, suspended President Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. The vote was slightly higher on this referral than the original vote taken in the Brazilian Senate. And I'm wondering if that portends the outcome of the pending trial, which takes place in a context of having been initiated by someone who has since been driven from power over evidence of deep corruption.
Well, as of this moment, it does not look very good with regard to Dilma Rousseff and her Workers' Party administration in Brasilia. If we step back for a moment, it's really stunning the comeback that U.S. imperialism has made in the Americas. It's not only Dilma Rousseff being on the ropes, it's Mr. Maduro in Venezuela being on the ropes. It's the fact that the party of Kirchner lost in Argentina. And I think that this may not necessarily be some sort of mad coincidence. We'll have to await to a degree the opening of the archives of the Obama Presidential Library in Chicago. But it's not premature to suggest that as we look and reflect on, say, Ukraine and the downturn of relations with Russia in 2014, that the U.S. administration and U.S. imperialism generally responded hysterically to the rise of the BRICS and all of the reportage that was coming out, say, in 2009, 2010, about the BRICS and Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa becoming this new hegemon on the international scene. And now, as we survey the BRICS and we look at the fact that, as noted, Rousseff is on the ropes, the downturn of relations with Russia, the war talk, loose war talk about China, and then, of course, there are the South African elections, where the African National Congress, just a few days ago, suffered a setback, losing major control of major cities. Now, let me first of all say that I don't think you can understand that South African result without understanding that global context. But at the same time, I do think that there is a point to be made about the inadequacies of Jacob Zuma, the president, who in some ways is an embarrassment to the international movement. I mean, there was just a demonstration in South Africa a day or two ago as they were announcing the election results, where a number of young women held up signs with regard to the rape victim, the woman that Jacob Zuma was accused of raping a few years ago. He was put on trial. He was able to escape conviction because of a scurrilous counterattack against this rape victim. And to show you how Jacob Zuma personally has compromised the ANC, the African National Congress Women's League felt compelled to defend Jacob Zuma after he was charged with rape of a young woman under very questionable circumstances, to put it mildly. And then, of course, there's his corruption, his Nkandla estate on the Indian Ocean side of South Africa, where millions of dollars in government funds were used to refurbish this estate, which, of course, houses him and his, I've lost track of how many wives he has. Is it four, five? I'm not really sure.
More than Johnny Carson.
So this has obviously compromised the ANC to a degree and has led directly to the result. I'm not sure if the ANC will move to dislodge him before presidential elections in 2019. But at the same time, I think it would be a mistake to just focus on Zuma as the sole culprit. Because even though this election has sent a signal to the ANC, it was not necessarily a progressive result. That is to say, the descendant of the old apartheid national party, the Democratic Alliance, did very well. I don't see how the ANC is going to move aggressively towards redistribution when the old national party descendant, the Democratic Alliance, is scoring in double digits and has at least black face leadership, if not. Right. Of course, not necessarily in terms of rank and file. And then there's the economic freedom fighters, led by Julius Malema, who once said as an ANC cadre that he would die, if not kill, for Jacob Zuma. This is when Jacob Zuma was in a conflict with his predecessor, Thabo Mbeki, the successor to Nelson Mandela as president, who, of course, was unseated in a kind of palace coup led by Jacob Zuma. Then, of course, Malema fell out with Zuma and started this other party, the EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters. They did quite well in the elections, too. And they ran on this platform of radical redistribution, you know, which I'm sure many of your listeners will say right on.
Yes, indeed.
The problem is that the EFF has said that it would be very difficult for them to enter an alliance with the ANC in terms of ruling these key South African cities. And that they're, as of now, this may change because it's a fluid situation, as of now, they're more prone to enter an alliance with the Democratic Alliance, which, of course, resists stoutly the idea of radical redistribution.
Right. Their constituency has all the wealth that they're talking about.
Right. So, I mean, this is obviously contradictory. So the South African citizenry, it seems to me, is going to have a very steep uphill climb going forward. And this is not even to mention the regional scenario. That is to say that we have many of our friends here in the United States, when you had an attempt at redistribution in Zimbabwe, and redistribution is not a very smooth and pretty process. There are going to be eggs cracked and dresses ruffled when you try to redistribute wealth and particularly land and property. And of course, that led to a clamoring against the government in Zimbabwe. That was actually one part of the bill of indictment against Thabo Mbeki. One of the reasons he was dislodged, it was said he was not aggressive enough in confronting the regime in Harare, Zimbabwe. And that led to the rise of Jacob Zuma. And I dare say that if there are moves towards radical redistribution of land and wealth in South Africa, that once again, eggs are going to be cracked, and some of our friends in the United States may be unsettled by that process, and I'm not sure where they'll end up, and that too will be complicating in terms of moving towards equity and true democracy, including economic democracy, in South Africa. So that's the situation as we speak.
And finally, we have like 3 minutes. Looking in South Africa, you also have the great game, quote unquote, that's going on between the U.S. and EU on one side, China on the other, and the alignment of political forces on the ground in relation to that. You want to talk to that?
Well, there's a lot of hysteria in the United States right now about the Chinese role in Africa. Your fellow New Yorker, Howard French, who teaches at Columbia University Journalism School and was a former New York Times correspondent in both Africa and China, has just written a recent book which sounds the alarm about alleged Chinese encroachments in Africa. It seems to me what this bespeaks is a kind of hysteria about the decline of U.S. imperialism and the fact that Africa historically has been a preserve not only for U.S. imperialism but North Atlantic imperialism. And if it seems as if the North Atlantic countries are losing their preserve, their foothold in Africa, this bespeaks a overall decline, particularly vis-a-vis China. And that's the message I took from Howard French's book. But there's another complicating factor as well, and that is that perhaps the closest ally on the African continent of Beijing is Zimbabwe. That relationship goes back to the 1960s, if not before, and to the beginnings of the Liberation War, ignited with the illegal unilateral declaration of independence by the racist minority regime, November 11, 1965. And what makes this more intriguing is that it has Cold War connotations, because what happened was that in terms of the standoff between Moscow and Beijing that characterized that period, the prevailing party in Zimbabwe, the ZANU-PF under President Robert Mugabe, was one of the few liberation movements that was four square in the corner of Beijing, as opposed to the ANC, which was much closer to Moscow. Although it's fair to say that the ANC did try to maintain positive relations with Beijing, but that was not always possible. That also had repercussions in terms of the conflict in Zimbabwe after land reform, because China was standing very closely to Harare, as noted, and I had warned the South African comrades that if they followed the advice of some of our left-wing friends in the United States, not to mention U.S. imperialism and British imperialism, and tried to confront Zimbabwe over land reform, that this could boomerang, given China's rising profile in the international community, and China's ability to mobilize with Zimbabwe against the South African regime. Fortunately, Jacob Zuma rejected the advice of British imperialism and of some of our left-wing friends, and contrary to what was thought, did not reverse Mbeki's policy towards Zimbabwe after he came into office. But this whole question of China's role in Africa is still hanging fire. China comes into play because what's happening globally right now is that a lot of production is moving across the Indian Ocean from China into East Africa, particularly Ethiopia, which has a population of about 100 million. It's estimated that by the end of the century, Ethiopia will be one of the 10 most populous nations on planet Earth, assuming that climate change or other catastrophes does not overcome us all. It's probably fair to say that U.S. imperialism is reassessing, and to come full circle, just like they were reassessing on July 15th, 2016, when it seemed that there was going to be a coup in Turkey.
Dr. Horn, thank you very much. We'll have to leave it there. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.